In this context, I'm interested about your ideas about the image being distributed through the net in low resolution, and how does this affect us, and from the perspective of a visual artist, for example, how do you treat your images?
Well, I simply noticed that many of the films, you know, film classics of experimental film or essay film or any type of, let's say, non-commercial, non-mainstream film which I had seen during my studies, for example, was gone from the public surface for a very long time. It was impossible to see many of those films in cinemas or on television or any of the mass media until they started re-emerging on the web, and big time. I mean, everything, I mean, not everything, obviously, but lots of things were there, and they could be watched, you know, by anyone for free. The only thing was that they were like a shadow of their former self. They were played in very low resolution. Sometimes it was very hard to see what's even on the film, but still, as a sort of working print, if you like, the quality was sufficient to at least guess what was going on. So I was trying to reflect about what that means, how images are sort of hollowed up and robbed of their material substance in order to be accelerated and to gain speed and velocity in traveling in those digital circuits. And for me, it's a really fascinating economy going on there, because on the one hand, the reason why many of these images circulate is because they are treated as a sort of commercial preview, if you like. You know, they are on the way of becoming a home video product or something like that. But on the other hand, this sort of circuit and the unpredictable connections it creates are also like the final fulfillment of the initial dreams of militant cinema and political cinema, to create communication circuits all over the world, you know, to connect, as it was called, the workers of the world to each other, and paradoxically in form of these really low resolution images which look like rags, you know. This dream has been sort of being realized in a very paradoxical form, in a form which is essentially very much controlled still by big media corporations, but which could also enable other types of connections to be made.
Some of the people are advocates of accessibility for any price, so in a way it is good for the people to be informed, but are they really informed about, for example, 1960s black and white film, for example, if they watch it in low resolution?
I think yes and no, because, I mean, at least they have the chance of seeing, like, a preview, you know. I mean, also, you know, let's say, during my studies, I didn't watch every film in the cinema. Many of the films were being watched on editing tables, and the images there are not so good either, you know. But still, we called that not a screening, but a viewing, if you like. And this was a sort of study situation. And I think this sort of study situation can be repeated. You won't see the real thing, of course. Maybe not the film itself, but very clearly the condition of its circulation. And I think that's interesting as well, you know, because this reveals the reality of today's communication circuits, which are very, very ambivalent, but very important also.
I will skip now to one work that hasn't, I think, yet been realized. I think it's entitled Europe Stream, and it's still a project to come, but I sense that in it you are going to compact somehow your critique of post-colonialism.
And yeah, no, I think this work can never be realized. I mean, this is I shot about 60 hours of material for it. It was about migratory realities of women inside Fortress Europe, if you like, but the scope was just too ambitious. So as I realized few parts, or let's say fragments of it, you know, so I don't think I will manage to, you know, it's a work of epic dimensions. I can't handle this at this stage. But let me tell you about some of the fragments. I realized it's one documentary, really, about a project which doesn't have anything to do with me, but which I happened to come across. Also a temporary project which has ended by now, which is called the Universal Embassy in Brussels, which was a project mainly by undocumented persons who realized, actually with the help of certain artist groups located in Brussels, that the Somali embassy in Brussels was empty because the Somali state was practically non-existent. So there was no ambassador, because at this stage Somalia was considered a failed state, was bankrupt, in a state of civil war. Anyhow, the embassy was empty and it was occupied by the undocumented people as a housing project, but also as a sort of political project, let's call it like that. And they called it the Universal Embassy because it was supposed to represent all those which were not represented by any other embassy. Doing this short documentation about the project when it was still operational, it's not anymore operational, was one of the fragments realized.
You've written a text, Can Subaltern Speak German? And could you tell me some more about what kind of ideas did you come to this text?
Yes, I mean, there was the simultaneous task and impossibility of translating and adapting post-colonial theory or approaches into a completely different context like Germany, which was not essentially and primarily defined by its colonial past, although Germany also has a colonial past, but which has many sorts of past being superimposed on each other. I mean, Germany is simultaneously post-colonial, a post-communist, and a post-fascist state. And all these realities are intertwined and sort of superimposed on top of each other, you know, so that the result is a sort of cryptic palimpsest of power relations, which are interrelated to each other, yet cannot be fully translated into each other. Let's say mainstream adaptation of post-colonial studies in Germany and also other places in Western Europe was to simply treat it as an exotic phenomenon which was happening somewhere else, you know, in the States or Caribbean or India or God knows where, and to completely ignore that it had very there were material realities in Germany which could be connected to this sort of theory, yet in this case the theory would have to be transformed and adapted to the historical and political circumstances of the situation. So actually I came to the conclusion that the post-colonial studies as they are and were are a very, let's say, local field of research, because usually they mainly deal with the aftermath of the British Empire. So if you want to take this into account, which I think needs to be done, then post-colonial studies will need to transform so radically that it will hardly be possible to call these fields post-colonial studies afterwards. But I think this is sort of the necessary process that will happen when this field of studies is going to be translated into local contexts.
How do you actually use these ideas in your films?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very annoyed with this ethnographic approach in documentary, which always tries to highlight the singular characteristics of certain culture, because that's not what's interesting for me in any culture. For me, it's more interesting the things which are not singular, which are the same everywhere, you know. So I'm more interested in what cultures have in common than what's different in them, you know. So how can we communicate? It's very interesting because one of the main global communicators is actually Bruce Lee. You can talk about Bruce Lee with anybody in the world, you know? And this is something which is a sort of universal cultural heritage, if you like. These are things that interest me, you know? not the exotic and specific properties of people which you can never fully understand, but the things which everybody paradoxically shares, or not everybody, obviously, and also different, you know, people obviously have different understandings of the same thing. But to have a common ground, or to highlight common grounds, is important for me much more than to highlight differences and to format people according to their cultural character.